How do you build a high-performing culture? This is Culture Architects, candid conversations with extraordinary leaders sharing their biggest successes, failures, and lessons learned on their culture journeys. Here's David J. Friedman.
So welcome back to our latest episode of Culture Architects. I have a real pleasure today to be able to introduce you to and give you audience members a chance to get to know Richard Miller. Richard Miller is one of the foremost leaders I can think of who knows more than just about anybody about building fantastic cultures in a healthcare system. And healthcare systems are pretty darn complex. Rich spent many years as the CEO of originally West Jersey Health System in Southern New Jersey, merged that into Memorial Hospital in Burlington County, which became the Virtua Health System, which was a very large health system in the Southern New Jersey, Philadelphia marketplace. Rich ran that for 22 years, and this was an organization that many times was named one of the best places to work in the area, was really highly focused on culture. And so few people know as much as Rich does about how to build culture in a complex organization like that. So, Rich, welcome. I'm thrilled to have you on the podcast.
Great to be here, David. Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you again.
Wow, my pleasure. So let's start with, I'm curious. I know from your years at Virtua that culture was always a priority of yours. When in your career did you have this like moment of, whether it was an individual moment of brilliance or maybe it was a gradual thing, where somewhere along the way in your leadership career, you had this recognition that culture was important? Like, where did that come from?
Well, David, I've always been a kind of person, and it's interesting, my original background, I was a finance person. I grew up in the finance world. People used to tease me, you're a finance person with a personality, and they're hard to find. I was always a people person along with that. So, as I grew in my career, I was in consulting, financial consulting for a number of years. And then when I came to West Jersey Health System back in 86, I started to take more of a leadership role in leading people. Part of that direction allowed me to understand more about the people issues and how people affect organizations. And you saw the good and bad side of things. You saw people that were driven to excellence and some people that weren't driven to excellence in helping the organization grow. So, through the early years in my finance, when I was the chief financial officer, there was more to do with the numbers and more to do with getting the organization back on its feet. But as I grew into a chief operating officer role and eventually a CEO role, I really understood that having good senior leadership and good people, and what I mean by good people, are people that care about the organization, are invested in the organization. And I learned that they were very important to the growth of the organization. So I tried to make sure that hiring was very important, hiring the right people in the senior leadership roles was very important. So it kind of started there when I became a COO and eventually a CEO, and I learned more about the people issues in an organization.
Wait, when you first took over as COO at West Jersey, I don't say this in like a derogatory way, but how would you describe the culture at that time when you first got into the organization?
Yeah, the culture was not what I would call a great culture. It was not something where people were rowing in the right direction for the organization. It really wasn't what I would call a total caring culture where people cared about each other, which to me was very important. We had four hospitals in the health system, and every hospital has its own culture. Right. But I think we were rowing in different directions, in all honesty, David. So it was difficult. It was very difficult.
And so what was the first thing you did when you said, all right, I see this, it's not particularly productive, it's not helping us, and we need to make some changes. What's the first thing that you started to work on to say, we got to make this different?
For me, it was starting on my skill set and making sure that people saw that I was doing something differently for them, that they saw me act in a proper way and saw me interact with the employee population and my teammates in a different way. So I was the kind of leader that was very engaged with getting out on the floor of my nurses, sitting in a nurse's station, talking to people about not just about work, but about life in general. letting people know that I was concerned about them as people and trying to make their lives better. And then taking action in areas, you know, David, that could affect change in, like providing education to my employees that we would pay for, to make sure that we showed them they were cared about. Right. So, you know, taking action in areas is very important, but also being out on the front lines and being very visible, that's where it started. It had to start with me as a leader. And, you know, I couldn't depend on, in so many organizations, people will say, well, that's the HR's job. It's HR's job to do that. And that's not the case. It's every leader has to be on board, but especially, you know, a chief operating officer or a chief executive officer has to lead first. So yeah. I felt like my role was to get out there among the folks and to, you know, to let them know that I cared about them and I was there for them.
Yeah. You know, I often make the comment, people ask me about, you know, what does it take to be successful in a culture initiative? And the way I always describe it is I say that the single most important ingredient in the success of any culture initiative is what I call CEO sponsorship. Your point that it starts at the top. Yep. Yes, HR and others are involved in it, but if you don't have the top executives sponsoring this, saying this is important, we're not going to get very far. And it sounds like that's your experience as well.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that comment, David. That is 100% accurate, and I feel very strongly about that. As I look at organizations today, if you walk into an organization and the CEO is not willing to sit down and talk about growth and culture, then you're not going to have a successful roadmap for cultural success. So it has to start at the top of the organization. They have to believe that they're leading the cultural charge and their senior team's leading it as well. I couldn't agree more.
And as I listen to what you said about how you started, what I take from that is, all right, there were two things you did initially. One is your leadership example, demonstrating that you genuinely, authentically cared about people and were interested in them. Mm-hmm. And then second, what I heard you say is, okay, yes, I mean, I've got to show that. But then when I hear things from them about things that are important or maybe things that aren't working or that we need to fix or be better about, you acted on that. So you showed them that you not only cared, but you cared enough to actually put some action behind that.
Yes.
Is that a way you'd describe that?
Yes, it is, David. In fact, you know, a couple examples of that are I put an employee advisory group in place that there were 30 employees or 35 employees from around my health system. We had approximately 10,000 people in the organization. So I put an employee advisory group, which had a representative from each arm of the organization. Mm-hmm. And in each location of the organization, there was a local employee change team, they were called. We called them LEX for short. But there were a number of those that people came through those up to the employee advisory group where they sat with me. And we used to meet monthly. And the interesting thing is, you know, we had when people first came onto the employee advisory group, you know, they thought Rich Miller had all the answers for them and I was going to fix everything. And basically, I turned that around to the employees. And when they came up with an issue, I said, well, how would you handle that? I mean, how would you fix it? You know, you're a better expert than I am at fixing something that's local. So what I did was I sent them back with a task and assigned a senior leader to it and to give them the help to get through the process. And 9 out of 10 times, whatever issue there was fixed. Mm-hmm. And it gave the employee ownership of the fix, which is very important. And they saw the value in that. So, nice. You know, those are things that once you develop that relationship with your employees and they're comfortable in the relationship, there becomes an openness and a dialogue that's very tangible that employees find very important to them. And then over time, what happened was people were asking to get on the employee advisory group from all the areas of the organization. Nice. So they wanted to participate. They wanted to sit with me and they wanted to talk to me about their issues. But, you know, it wasn't Rich Miller fixing things. It was about how do we do this together and how do you find the answers and helping them understand they could do this at the local level. They didn't have to wait for Rich Miller to fix it.
So what's interesting about that to me, Rich, is that I think about this seems pretty obvious that what you did is you demonstrated that the reason people wanted to be on that committee is because they learned from your experience and their experience that it makes a difference, that it's not a waste of time, that actually, if I bring something up, something might come of this, so it's worth my time and effort. And it seems like such an obvious thing to demonstrate to people that you care, that you're listening and responding to the things that they say would make this a great place to be. Right. So why do you think, as obvious as that is to you and me, why do so many leaders not get this?
That's a great question. A short answer is I really don't know, because to me it's pretty obvious. I mean, it's a very successful formula in building a great culture. But you know what it is too? I think there's a lot of effort involved in doing that type of approach. You have to be in front of it at all times. You have to be out in front. You know, the CEO is constantly out there doing these types of things to make sure that because culture is worked on every day, and you know this as well as I do, David. It's an everyday process. You don't take a day off in building culture. So the engagement of the CEO and of senior leadership is every day. So, you know, you can't be sitting in your office pushing papers or being on email all the time. You have to make a conscious effort to get out and about with your employees, to get out and talk to your employees. So it's not an easy thing to do. And if you're a bit introverted or you don't like doing that, it can be difficult. I can imagine it can be difficult, and that becomes an issue at that point. So, you know, to me, it was easy because I enjoyed meeting with people. I enjoyed seeing people. And let me say this to you, David, not every meeting and not every time I went out, it was a joyful experience. I mean, there were times, you know, there were times people had real concerns and were not happy about certain things, and he had to have difficult conversations. And I always used the phrase that, you know, people may not have agreed with certain decisions I made as a leader, but I wanted them to understand why I made the decision, and that they may disagree, but they ended up respecting what I did because I explained it to them. So most people are pretty reasonable once they understand why you did something, although they still may disagree. But to answer your question, it's very hard work to build culture every day. It's not an easy process. So I think some CEOs and some leaders take a pass on it for that reason. They just don't want to do the heavy lifting.
Yeah, you may be very right. So let me ask you this. You know, you've seen and know from our own exchanges about the 8-step framework that I use to organize the steps that it takes, in my experience, in order to purposely go about creating a culture. And so I'd like to just sort of go through those 8 steps as it relates to your experience, certainly at Virtua, and perhaps even other experiences where you've worked with others. So let's start with, you know, the first step to me is you can't purposely create a specific culture if you can't articulate, well, what is it that we're trying to create? How do we define what is the culture we want? So in your Virtua days, how did you define what is the culture? Was there a set of values, behaviors? What did you have that this is what our culture is?
Yeah, I mean, we had a set of values and behaviors we lived by. You know, there were 4 or 5 values we lived by. And we also built something, David, we called the STAR Initiative at Virtua that everybody could relate to. And it had a 5-point STAR we built, and everybody had it in their location. And it was simple enough to follow. And it was built around, patient satisfaction, employee engagement, financial success, clinical success, and also caring culture. Those were the 5 points of the STAR. Okay. And we measured those 5 points of the STAR with certain measurements. And one of the things I learned early on from working with our employees was that they wanted to be accountable. People, most people want to be accountable. They want to do excellent. They want to learn to be excellent. And if you give them the accountable measurements that they could live by, they typically do it. And we built this STAR initiative with measurement goals around it. And it allowed our employees to gravitate to something. And I also, it was funny, when I started this, after I did the merger with Memorial Hospital and we formed Virtua in 97, in about the year 2000, I sat down with our 500 managers, and I said to them, you know, guys, we're average. We're 50th percentile in every measure we have, you know, we're trying to measure. And that's when I introduced the STAR initiative. And I said, you know, and it was a little bit of tough love, David, for the team. But yeah, I said,
being told you're average, people don't love that.
Yeah. And I said to them, you know, some of us might not want to do this, and that's fine. You may want to exit the organization, but we're going to measure relentlessly, and we're going to live by our values. And that's the expectation. So we did that, and we put measurements in place, and some people opted out of the organization, which was fine.
Right.
And we helped them opt out. We supported them. But the people that remained really gravitated to this accountable culture. It became the norm for us to understand excellence. And within a couple of years, we were 90th percentile. We became nationally recognized for our quality and safety because people really got on board and understood what we were trying to do. People want to be accountable. You make sure the people that remain with you are outstanding, and you know, they deliver what they're expected to deliver, and that happened.
So the first step in there is you brought more clarity to what excellence meant. You know, through the STAR initiative, these are the things. This is what it looks like to be great in this organization. This is the culture we're trying to build.
Right.
The second step that you know I always talk about is, I call it creating rituals, which is how do we live these things in a way that they become, that we teach them with enough repetition that they become internalized. So what were some of the rituals that happened in the virtuous system that you created, or the organization created, to help people live these things? Were there certain routines that happened? We had whether it was a regular meeting or what? Tell me about some of those.
Yeah, I mean, the one big one that I can put, there were a number of them, but the one that became a major ritual for us was the best people, what we call best people review.
Okay.
And we would sit down four times a year and review our employees and our management team. And this included me in the room. So we would bring in our leadership from around Virtua. And it became a situation where there were two full day sessions of this four times a year. And we thought it was important enough, David, that we did this religiously, that we stuck to this. And I told people, we don't miss these meetings, gang. The crux of the organizations are people. And they weren't, those meetings were not done to penalize people. They were done to review the excellence of people. And I used the GE playbook, what they called Session C, it's GE. And I stole it from them a little bit. And we had three categories of excellent, meets expectations, and needs improvement. Okay. And people fit in those categories. And in the early days, you know, what GE used to do is, which we did, is, you know, if you need improvement, some of those people will eventually have to move out of the organization, especially if they're in the needs improvement category a couple times.
Right.
And the only time that didn't happen for us was if we felt somebody was in the wrong job. There's some people that just aren't in. They're good people. They have good values, but they're not in the right spot. And for those folks, we would move them to a place where they would fit. The discussions were very prolonged. We sat for hours. And what I basically did was developed a, you know, kind of our list of superstars in the organization for growth. And that allowed us to build the organization even greater. You know, what are the people we can't afford to lose in the organization? Who are they? And it could be at any level of the organization. That meeting happened four times a year. And what spawned out of that meeting for my time at Virtua was there were certain leaders in the organization or certain management people in the organization that we would have lunch with Rich. So if there was a person or people, David, that I felt that we really wanted to build something with them because they had the skill sets we really needed for the future, I would have lunch with them and basically say to them, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? What do you want to do in this organization? We value you and we want you to be part of this organization. So tell me what your dreams are. And we would have those lunches and I would have those lunches, and they became very positive lunches for people, and they really enjoyed them and kept people within the organization. We didn't lose them. So, and that's what I mean. It's hard work to do this because, you know, it's time consuming to really make sure your people are thought about and cared about. So That was an example. Another example would be that I attended almost every orientation on Monday morning for our new employees.
Nice.
Which honestly was when I went there, I had people there, they were seeing me for the first time and part of the organization for the first time. And I had people astonishingly, one guy raised his hand, I'll never forget, he said, "Mr. Miller, I have to tell you something. I've been to 5 or 6 organizations. I've never seen a CEO at orientation."
Right.
And my point to him was, and to everybody, and there must have been 90 people in the room, I said, "You're our future. We value who you are as people. And you're here to make Virtua a better place to work. And you're here to care about the person that you work next to." So I wanted them to understand that from my vantage point. And boy, I got to tell you, that set the table for them moving forward, you know. So
absolutely,
those are things that, you know, some of the rituals, there's more, but there are examples of some of the things.
Yeah. In that 8-step framework that I'm referring to, the 4th step of those, we'll come back to the 3rd one in a moment, but the 4th one is what I call, just my own language, I call it integration, which is what you're describing as orientation. Some people call it orientation, onboarding, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. I use the word integration, but my point is always when I teach this, I say to people all the time that the first day, the first week of somebody's career with your company is just about the most important week in their entire career. And,
correct.
You know, you gave evidence to that, just your, even the symbolic aspect of you being there, like that person, how they were astonished, symbolically, regardless of anything that comes out of your mouth, you're saying you are important. This is important. I care about you and how you get started. And that influences the rest of their career.
Yeah, it really does. And actually it was funny, you know, as I walked the hallways of Virtua, the new orientees used to come up to me and says, "Mr. Miller, I remember you coming to orientation," and so forth. And it really stuck with them. It was really a positive impression for new
people. You contrast that with so many organizations that say all these great things, and then somebody new starts and they don't pay enough attention to how they get started. And the person comes in and their computer isn't ready. Their business cards aren't there. Nobody knows what they're going to do next. They spend half the time filling out forms, and that's their first impression. You think, oh my gosh, there's so much more we could do this better. So really important.
It's also important, David, that your HR team understands that, you know, that this is the most important thing we're doing. You just said the paperwork, everything else comes second to really bring the person on board in a proper way, in a framework that they're cared about and that they're coming to a very special organization. And it was really funny, in some of the orientation sessions, I had employees that said, that raised their hand, and it was their second time at Virtua. And they often said, you know, "Mr. Miller, we always thought," and they always, I said, "Call me Rich, call my dad, Mr. Miller, call me Rich." And So they said, "Rich, we left thinking for a better position somewhere else, and we're back because there's nothing like working here that you really cared about." So that reaffirmed the things we were doing. It really did.
Yeah. That's fascinating. So let's stop right here, because coming up in the second part of my conversation with Rich Miller, the retired CEO of Virtua Health, Rich is going to share the 2 principles that guided his leadership journey.
I told my team, ethics and values, nobody will cross that line with me. And if they do, they'll be gone in a New York minute. So that I would not tolerate. You know, if somebody made a bad business decision, I can live with that. We'll figure out a way to move forward and help fix those things. But values and ethics are things we don't cross.
This has been Culture Architects with David J. Friedman. Be sure to join us next time for more insights and wisdom from great leaders from all walks of life. To book David for your events or to learn more about his writing, speaking, or consulting, go to davidjfriedman.com. Culture Architects with David J. Friedman is a production of Forbes Books.